You know, usually when we think about a murder mystery, there's this expectation of a really clean mathematical equation.
Right, yeah. A crime happens, clues are gathered.
Yeah, and a sharp investigator slowly pieces the puzzle together until the identity of the killer is just dramatically revealed in the final act.
It operates on a highly procedural formula. I mean, the tension you feel as a consumer of that story is derived almost entirely from the unknown.
You're just waiting for the veil to be lifted. You know, who committed the crime?
Right. And once you finally know the answer to that question, the tension instantly resolves.
The case is closed, the equation balances out, and you get to walk away feeling pretty satisfied.
We gravitate toward that structure because it offers a comforting, if illusory sense of justice. It tells us that a chaotic, violent world can actually be ordered and understood through simple logic.
But then you step into the feverish, suffocating world of 19th century St. Petersburg, and suddenly that entire formula is violently inverted.
Yeah, it's completely flipped. We know who the killer is immediately.
In fact, we are trapped inside his mind while he plans the murder. We literally feel his hands shaking as he grips the weapon. And the rest of the story is an agonizing, inescapable psychological freefall.
It really is.
Welcome to this Book Candy Companion Conversation from Claire and Horatio. Today we are focusing on Fyodor Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment.
And if you have ever thought of this 1866 Russian novel as like a dusty, impenetrable historical artifact meant only for academics, well, prepare to have that illusion completely shattered.
Oh, for sure. This is essential listening for right now. It operates as the ultimate psychological thriller about the extreme dangers of living entirely inside your own theories, sealed off in an echo chamber of your own brilliance.
The protagonist, Rodion Raskolnikov, creates this highly rationalized philosophical framework that deliberately isolates him from the rest of humanity.
And what the novel does is force us to sit in the front row and watch the devastating, visceral consequences of that self-imposed isolation.
It's intense.
Okay, let's unpack this right away. Instead of picturing a man in a dusty top hat from the 1860s, I want you to think of Raskolnikov as the 19th century equivalent of a brilliant but intensely toxic Silicon Valley disruptor.
Oh, that's a really good way to frame it.
Right.
Right.
He's a young man who genuinely believes his own towering intellect exempts him from the standard moral rules of humanity. He wants to break the system because he thinks he's fundamentally superior to it.
Yeah, the rules just don't apply to him.
But wait, before we get into the mind of this character, we have to talk about the mind of the author. Like, how does a guy sitting at a desk conjure up this level of visceral panic?
Well, you really cannot separate the frantic, desperate energy of this prose from Dostoevsky's actual
It
life.
was pretty rough, wasn't it?
Oh, incredibly rough. He was born to a relatively poor doctor who worked in a charity hospital in Moscow, meaning from a very young age, he was exposed to the lowest, most destitute layers of Russian society.
Which obviously shows up in his writing.
Yeah, everywhere. He achieved some early literary success in his 20s with a novel called Poor Folk, and he was hailed as a rising star. But that entire trajectory was violently interrupted in 1849.
Right, he was arrested by the Tsarist secret police. Arrested for what, though? Was he actively plotting a violent rebellion or
No
something?
one at all. He was associating with the Petrushevsky Circle.
Which was what, a militia?
No, just the group of young progressive intellectuals. They gathered to read subversive political and utopian socialist texts by French writers like Fourier and Proudhon.
So they were essentially just having a book club about social reform.
Basically, yeah. But you have to understand the political climate. Tsar Nicholas was terrified of the democratic revolutions that had swept across Europe in 1848.
Right, the establishment was panicking.
Huge panic.
Yeah.
Under his strict regime, simply discussing these ideas or, reading a banned letter criticizing the government was considered a capital offense.
Wow, so they essentially got the death penalty for running a progressive book club.
Yes. And this leads to one of the most harrowing psychological experiences any writer has ever endured.
The mock execution.
Right. On December 22, 1849, Dostoevsky and 21 other prisoners were taken to Semyonovsky Square in St. Petersburg. It was freezing cold, well below zero.
Unimaginable.
They were stripped of their warm clothes, forced to put on the thin white shirts worn by the condemned, and bound to stakes in groups of three.
I read the letter he wrote to his brother Mikhail about this exact morning. Dostoevsky was in the second row,
He
right?
was, yeah.
He calculated that he had maybe 3 to 5 minutes left to live. He kissed the cross offered by a priest, kissed his friends next to him, and literally prepared his soul for death.
He describes staring at a church dome shining in the winter sun, thinking he would soon merge with that light.
The troops aimed their rifles.
Yeah.
The drums rolled. They were seconds away from being obliterated.
And then at the very last possible instant, a theatrical messenger arrived on horseback, announcing that the Tsar, in his infinite mercy, had commuted their sentences to hard labor in Siberia.
Hold on. So the Tsar knew all along he wasn't going to kill him. Was this an actual legal proceeding or just pure psychological torture?
It was entirely premeditated psychological torture.
That is just sick.
It was a mock execution designed by the state to completely break the spirits of these young intellectuals before sending them off to rot. And, I mean, it worked on some.
What do you mean?
Well, one of Dostoevsky's fellow prisoners, a man named Grigoryev, literally lost his mind the moment he was untied from the stake. He went insane on the spot and never regained his sanity.
Oh, man. Which raises an incredibly important question. What does a trauma like that, believing with every fiber of your being that you were going to die in 60 seconds and then having your life violently handed back to you, what does that do to a human brain?
It rewires you completely.
And how does that translate into the pacing and mood of a novel written years later? Because when you listen to Crime and Punishment, you physically feel a ticking clock. You feel the sweat on the character's brows.
It translates into a pervasive, inescapable sense of life or death urgency. Every single conversation in this book feels as though it is happening on the very edge of a precipice.
There is no casual small talk anywhere.
None. And remember, after that mock execution, Dostoevsky spent 4 years in a Siberian prison camp, a place called a katorga. He was surrounded by actual hardened murderers and criminals.
It's just a brutal environment.
He slept on wooden planks. He wore 10-pound shackles on his ankles for 4 straight years. His only reading material was a copy of the New Testament given to him by the wives of exiled revolutionaries.
And even when he finally gets out of Siberia, serves mandatory military time, and returns to St. Petersburg to write this novel in the 1860s, his life is still a waking nightmare, right? He hasn't found peace at all.
Far from it. His physical and financial conditions were arguably just as crushing as prison. He was suffering from violent, debilitating epileptic seizures.
And medical understanding of epilepsy back then was basically non-existent.
Primitive. The seizures were entirely unpredictable.
And from what I understand, the specific type of epilepsy he had involved a terrifying sequence. First, an aura where he felt this sudden, overwhelming sense of cosmic harmony and brilliant light.
Followed immediately by a horrific scream.
Right. A loss of consciousness, violent convulsions, and then days of profound, crushing depression and paranoia.
You see that extreme biological swing mirrored perfectly in Raskolnikov's emotional swing.
Oh, for sure.
Right.
From manic, grandiose confidence to absolute paralyzing terror.
And on top of the illness, Dostoevsky was crushed by poverty. His brother Mikhail had died, leaving behind massive debts.
So Dostoevsky took them on.
Yeah, out of a sense of duty. He took on all of his brother's financial liabilities to save the widow and children from total ruin. Plus, he had his own stepson to care for. He was utterly destitute.
So he was writing at what his translators have called heartbreaking speed. He signed a predatory contract with a publisher named Stolovsky.
A terrible contract.
Yeah, it stipulated that if Dostoevsky did not deliver a new novel by a specific date, he would lose the rights to all his past and future works for 9 years without compensation.
Just wild pressure. He was literally writing to outrun his creditors, often sending uncorrected wet pages straight to the printer.
The desperation of the author is the exact blueprint for the desperation of his characters.
Mm.
There is zero distance between Dostoevsky's real-world suffering and the suffocating, panicked atmosphere he builds around Raskolnikov.
So true.
So let's map out this core narrative to orient you before we get into the deeper psychology. We follow Rodion Raskolnikov, a remarkably handsome, highly intelligent former university student who has dropped out of law school due to crushing poverty.
He lives in a claustrophobic, coffin-like garret under the roof of a 5-story building in St. Petersburg.
He is starving. He sneaks past his landlady's door on the stairs because he owes her months of rent, and his clothes are practically rags.
You have to consider the physical reality of a starving brain. In the state of severe caloric deprivation, physical immobility, and total social isolation, his mind becomes a breeding ground for dangerous abstractions.
Right.
Raskolnikov drafts an article published in a local journal where he outlines a deeply concerning theory. He argues that all of humanity is divided into two distinct categories.
The ordinary and the extraordinary.
Yes. There is the ordinary mass of people, the material, the herd. Their sole purpose is to reproduce and obey the laws of society.
And then there are the extraordinary men.
These are the visionaries, the Napoleons, the Newtons, the Lycurguses. Raskolnikov theorizes that these extraordinary men have an inherent right, perhaps even a moral obligation, to step over established moral boundaries.
Meaning, if their grand ideas require the shedding of blood to move humanity forward, they are allowed to shed it. They are not bound by the laws of ordinary men. I want to push back on this a little, because if you look at Raskolnikov, it feels like a massive leap of logic. He's not a general commanding armies. He's not a CEO. He's a college dropout living in a closet.
It's delusional.
How does a guy in that pathetic state actually justify taking a literal axe to an old woman and acting like it's a profound favor to human society?
Because the theory is born out of intense psychological compensation. His reality is so humiliating, so devoid of agency, that his intellect creates a grandiose fantasy to protect his ego.
He decides to test this theory to prove to himself that he is a Napoleon, not a louse.
He targets an elderly pawnbroker named Alyona Ivanovna.
And we should explain the role of a pawnbroker in 1860 St. Petersburg. This was a time of massive social upheaval following the emancipation of the serfs in 1861.
Peasants were flooding into the city.
Right. A new brutal capitalist class was forming, and people were desperately poor. Pawnbrokers were the gatekeepers of survival. You bring them a silver watch or a ring, they give you a fraction of its worth at exorbitant interest rates.
And if you miss a payment by one day, they keep your item and sell it.
To Raskolnikov, Alyona Ivanovna represents the ultimate parasite. She is hoarding wealth, she beats her younger, simple-minded sister, and she profits off the misery of the poor.
He rationalizes that by killing her, taking her hoarded money, and using it to fund his own brilliant future and help his impoverished mother and sister, he is performing a utilitarian good.
He calculates that one small crime is easily outweighed by 1,000 good deeds. It is pure, cold mathematics.
He plans this murder meticulously. He walks the route, counting the exact number of steps from his building's gate to hers.
730 steps.
He creates a dummy pledge, a fake item made of wood wrapped in iron and tied with a complex knot, just to keep her hands busy while he strikes.
He even sews a loop into the inside of his overcoat so he can carry an axe through the streets without anyone seeing it. He goes to her apartment, he distracts her, and he brutalizes her with the blunt side of the axe.
But this is where the cold mathematics of his theory collide violently with the messy, unpredictable chaos of human reality.
Yeah, things do not go as planned.
Raskolnikov imagined this crime as a surgical strike, the calculated removal of an infection. But the reality of murder is physically exhausting, horrifying, and incredibly sloppy.
And then the ultimate variable ruins his equation. The pawnbroker's younger sister, Lizaveta, unexpectedly walks in on the crime scene.
Lizaveta is gentle, innocent, heavily exploited by her sister, and possibly pregnant.
And in a moment of sheer, blind animal panic, Raskolnikov murders her as well. He brings the sharp blade of the axe down on this innocent woman who doesn't even raise her hands to protect her face.
This is the pivotal rupture of the novel. He intended to commit a philosophical, elevated crime. Instead, he commits a terrifying, cowardly double butchery.
From that exact moment, the bulk of the novel shifts. We are no longer waiting to find out who did it. The engine driving the plot becomes, why did he actually do it? And how on earth will he survive the aftermath?
Raskolnikov enters a state of near-constant delirium. He sleeps for days, wakes up in screaming panics, hallucinates, and feverishly tries to hide the stolen goods under a rock in a courtyard.
He is pursued by a brilliant, highly unorthodox police investigator named Porfiry Petrovich.
The brilliance of the plot is how it systematically dismantles Raskolnikov's initial argument. He thought he could kill without consequence because his intellect elevated him above ordinary human emotion.
He thought conscience was just a social construct. But did he really feel guilt immediately, though, or was he just terrified of the police catching him?
That is the crucial distinction Dostoevsky makes. Raskolnikov isn't initially sorry for the women. He is furious with himself for botching the job.
So his ego is bruised.
Yeah, but his true punishment is not the physical threat of the police or the looming Siberian prison camp. The punishment is the immediate agonizing alienation from humanity.
The second the axe falls, he realizes his theory has completely severed him from the human race. When his loving mother and his devoted sister Dunya arrive in St. Petersburg to visit him, he physically recoils from them.
He cannot endure their embraces.
He realizes that by stepping over the moral law, he has placed himself on the other side of an unbridgeable chasm. He cannot speak to anyone truthfully ever again.
Alongside this internal torment, his path continuously collides with other desperate souls who are struggling to survive the crushing machinery of the city. We meet Marmeladov, a ruined, chronic drunkard who steals his own family's money to feed his addiction.
We meet Svidrigailov, a wealthy, depraved predator harboring very dark secrets.
And we meet Sonya, Marmeladov's daughter, a deeply spiritual girl forced to obtain a yellow ticket, the official ID of a prostitute, simply to keep her younger siblings from starving to death.
Svidrigailov is such an unsettling character. I have to admit, on my first read, I didn't fully grasp his function. Is he just a random villain thrown in for extra drama?
Svidrigailov is one of the most vital mechanisms in the novel. In literary terms, he is Raskolnikov's double or shadow. Svidrigailov is what happens when the extraordinary man theory actually succeeds.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Svidrigailov has wealth. He has power. He feels no moral guilt. And he steps over boundaries constantly to satisfy his own desires. He is the terrifying, logical conclusion of Raskolnikov's philosophy.
And what is his reward for achieving that total freedom from morality?
Complete suicidal boredom. He feels nothing. He describes his vision of eternity not as some grand celestial kingdom, but as a tiny, soot-blackened bathhouse in the countryside, filled with spiders in the corners.
That is so bleak.
Svidrigailov shows Raskolnikov the absolute dead end of a life lived without human connection.
Because of this incredibly heavy philosophical premise, modern audiences often carry a massive misconception about what it actually feels like to experience this story.
Right, they assume it's just grim.
When you hear the phrase 19th century Russian literature, you instinctively brace yourself for a dry, solemn, painfully slow slog through dense political theory. You imagine aristocrats sipping tea and giving long, boring speeches.
But the reality of this text is entirely different. It is incredibly chaotic, darkly comic, and deeply messily human.
Dostoevsky has an unparalleled, almost cinematic eye for the grotesque and the absurd. The profound tragedy is constantly undercut by scenes of wild, unhinged social embarrassment and biting bureaucratic satire.
Yes.
Okay, let's unpack this with a specific example. Take the disastrous funeral banquet for the drunkard Marmeladov. Marmeladov is run over by a horse-drawn carriage in the street.
Brutal scene.
His widow, Katerina Ivanovna, is dying of consumption tuberculosis. She is coughing up blood daily. She has young, starving children. And what does she do with the small amount of charity money Raskolnikov gives her?
She spends every last borrowed penny on a lavish funeral meal to prove her aristocratic origins to her miserable, low-class neighbors. It is an act of pure, irrational pride.
And it devolves into an absolute circus. She invites the Polish lodgers, who only show up to eat the free food. She gets into a vicious screaming match with her German landlady, Amalia Ivanovna.
They fight over the silver spoons.
They are fighting over social status, over silver spoons, and over a green boarding school shawl. Katerina is literally clapping her hands and mocking the landlady's thick German accent while coughing blood into her handkerchief.
It is horrifying. You feel terrible for the children, but it is also a masterclass in dark comedy. It is a reality TV show fight happening in an 1860s slum.
Comedy and tragedy in Dostoevsky's world are the exact same emotion, just expressed a few degrees apart.
The environment itself acts as a pressure cooker that forces these absurd collisions. The St. Petersburg of this novel is not the pristine, quiet, snowy wonderland of romantic Russian myths. It is the middle of July.
The heat. The text makes you feel how oppressive it is. St. Petersburg was built on a swamp. In the summer, it is sweltering, airless, and stinking.
The streets are filled with scaffolding, brick dust blowing into people's eyes, the overwhelming stench of cheap pothouses, and drunken men collapsing in the Haymarket Square.
Raskolnikov's wandering through the city is a sensory nightmare. The text notes that special Petersburg stench, the lack of oxygen that works painfully on Raskolnikov's already overwrought nervous system.
The environmental claustrophobia perfectly mirrors his mental state. He is trapped in his tiny yellow room, trapped in the suffocating heat of the city, and trapped inside his own failing, contradictory rationalizations.
Every interaction is forced, immediate, and highly volatile. People do not converse politely in this book. They collide.
Right.
To truly appreciate this chaotic brilliance, there are a few specific moments in the audiobook you should keep an ear out for. These are crucial markers that anchor the entire psychological architecture of the story. Let us start with the reading of Lazarus from the Gospel of St. John.
This is a profound, almost unbearably tense scene. Raskolnikov goes to Sonya's sparse, slanted room. Both of them are outcasts who have crossed a terrible line. He's taken a life and she has been forced to sell her body.
He notices a New Testament on her table and demands that she read the story of the raising of Lazarus to him. Why Lazarus specifically? There are hundreds of stories in the Bible.
Because Lazarus had been dead for 4 days, the biblical text explicitly notes that he was already stinking in the tomb.
So Raskolnikov sees himself in that.
Raskolnikov recognizes that he too is morally and spiritually dead, rotting in the tomb of his own theories. He wants to know if Sonia actually believes a man who is completely gone can be brought back to life.
And you hear Sonia, terrified, shaking, reading by the light of a flickering candle end. Her voice breaks like an overstrained string. Her breath catches as she reads the verse about the dead man emerging from the tomb.
Dostoevsky explicitly frames this image for us. He describes the murderer and the harlot who had so strangely been reading together the eternal book.
It is the emotional turning point of the novel. Raskolnikov's highly educated, arrogant intellect has brought him nothing but death.
While Sonia, who is uneducated but possesses a raw, unshakable faith and a capacity for boundless empathy, represents the faint, almost impossible possibility of his resurrection.
The second major dynamic to listen for is the psychological cat and mouse game between Raskolnikov and the investigator, Porfiry Petrovich. This is where the intellectual tension reaches a boiling point.
If you are expecting a standard detective who inspects footprints with a magnifying glass and analyzes cigar ash, you will be shocked.
I would compare Porfiry to the modern television detective Columbo. He plays the bumbling, disorganized, highly eccentric fool just to disarm his suspect.
He wears a dressing gown, he paces around aimlessly, he offers cigarettes, and he constantly apologizes for his own scattered thoughts.
But beneath that exterior is a razor-sharp psychological profiler. He doesn't look for physical evidence, he looks for psychological fractures.
During one of their interrogations, Raskolnikov goes in prepared for a formal legal battle, ready to parry every question.
But Porfiry refuses to ask him anything direct. Instead, they end up debating the exact article Raskolnikov wrote months ago about the extraordinary man. Porfiry already read it and knows exactly how Raskolnikov thinks.
What's intriguing here is Porfiry's specific analogy regarding his investigative methods. He tells Raskolnikov directly to his face that he does not need to arrest his primary suspect right away.
He says a criminal is like a butterfly around a candle.
He explains that if he leaves the suspect completely alone physically, but lets him know he is being watched, the suspect will circle and circle the flame.
The suspect will lose his mind from the suspense, overthinking every interaction.
Until finally, driven by the inescapable laws of psychology and human nature, the criminal will fly straight into the investigator's mouth.
It is a terrifying, ruthless tactic. Porfiry uses Raskolnikov's own massive intellect against him. He allows Raskolnikov to tangle himself in his own brilliant, arrogant lies.
Porfiry knows that a genius will overcomplicate his defense until the sheer exhaustion of maintaining the facade breaks him down.
At one point, a painter named Nikolai bursts into the room and falsely confesses to the murder. Raskolnikov thinks he is saved.
But Porfiry doesn't buy the false confession for a second. He knows Nikolai is confessing out of a religious desire to suffer, a very specific cultural phenomenon of the time. Porfiry knows it was Raskolnikov, and he calmly tells him so, advising him to confess on his own terms to mitigate his sentence.
The third motif you really need to notice is the constant use of thresholds and isolation. Pay attention to how often the most crucial dramatic scenes take place, not comfortably seated inside a room, but in doorways, on staircases, in narrow passages, or on bridges.
Raskolnikov spends the entire novel in spaces of transition. He physically faints upon the threshold of the police station when he first hears the murder being discussed.
During the crime, he stands paralyzed behind the door of the murdered woman's apartment, holding his breath, while two men stand on the other side trying the latch.
He wanders the bridges of St. Petersburg, staring down into the dark, murky water of the Neva River, watching a woman attempt suicide and contemplating doing the same.
And near the end, he falls to his knees and kisses the dirty, spit-covered earth of the Haymarket in a public square, trying to reconnect with the soil, with the ordinary people he despised.
He constantly tells Sonia that he feels separated from the rest of humanity by an impossible gulf.
These threshold spaces represent his state of spiritual and moral limbo. He has stepped out of the moral order of society, he's broken the law, but he lacks the ruthless sociopathy to become the elevated superhuman Napoleon he dreamed of being.
He is stuck in the doorway between two worlds, completely unable to exist in either. He is in purgatory.
These scenes rely so heavily on the specific cadence of the dialogue, the frantic pacing, and the sudden vocal breakdowns of the characters. And this leads us to why this particular book absolutely demands to be heard, rather than just read silently.
If you sit alone in a quiet room reading this on a page, silent reading can sometimes flatten the manic energy of Dostoevsky's prose. Hearing it performed by a skilled narrator transforms the experience entirely.
Dostoevsky was utterly obsessed with sound. He builds an oppressive, inescapable auditory landscape. Think of the horrific, continuous ringing of the pawnbroker's tin bell.
Raskolnikov rings it, and it has this specific, weak, tinny sound.
Long after the murder, he has a terrifying nightmare where he goes back to the apartment, hits the old woman with the axe, and instead of bleeding, she just sits there laughing, and the bell keeps ringing and ringing.
The sound becomes a physical manifestation of his inescapable guilt.
We hear the frantic whispers in the pitch-black stairwells. We hear the women weeping through the thin, paper-like walls. We hear the drunken peasants singing a song called The Hamlet in the filthy tavern.
We hear the constant shouting of the landladies. You have to experience Marmeladov's slurred, tragic monologue in the tavern.
He's a highly educated man, eloquently describing his own degradation, confessing to a stranger how he stole the money his daughter earned from prostitution just to buy another quart of spirits. You have to hear this self-loathing in his voice.
The characters rarely just speak calmly. The narrative notes that they erupt, they stammer, they rant feverishly, they laugh inappropriately at moments of intense tragedy.
An audio performance captures what the philosopher Mikhail Bakhtin famously called the polyphony of Dostoevsky's world.
Right.
Can we translate that for a listener who isn't a literary theorist? What does polyphony mean in this context?
Normally, a 19th century author is like a puppeteer. The author has a distinct worldview, and all the characters exist just to serve the author's point. The author is clearly in control.
But Bakhtin argued that Dostoevsky does something revolutionary.
He creates polyphony, multiple competing, fully realized voices and worldviews that clash simultaneously. Dostoevsky lets his characters off the leash.
Raskolnikov, Porfiry, Sonia, Svidrigailov, they all argue with each other, and they even argue with Dostoevsky's own deeply held beliefs.
It sounds like a genuine chaotic debate where no one is fully in charge. It emphasizes the sheer panic and desperation of the characters in a way that visual reading simply cannot fully convey.
You literally hear the frantic beating of Raskolnikov's heart and the pacing of the sentences. The punctuation itself feels like hyperventilation. And that desperation, driven by ideological obsession, is what makes the book so undeniably relevant today.
It really is.
Here's where it gets really interesting. If you are listening to this right now, you might be thinking, okay, this is a look at 19th century Russian poverty, but what does an axe murderer have to do with my life? How does Raskolnikov's article, the one dividing humanity into ordinary material and extraordinary rule breakers, apply to the 21st century?
It is a terrifyingly modern framework. We can draw a direct, unbroken line between Raskolnikov's theory and the modern ethos of certain tech sectors, venture capital cultures, or extreme political movements.
The entire move fast and break things mentality is a modern iteration of Raskolnikov's article.
It is the exact mindset where highly intelligent, incredibly driven people convince themselves that their grand disruptive vision for the future of humanity justifies immense collateral damage in the present.
They believe that the standard rules of ethics, privacy, labor laws, or social stability are necessary for the ordinary masses to keep order, but that their specific genius grants them a personal exemption.
They view the disruptions they cause, whether that means wiping out local economies, eroding privacy, or spreading misinformation, as the necessary cost of progress.
Raskolnikov uses this exact same utilitarian calculus. He justifies his brutal crime by claiming the pawnbroker was just a vile, noxious insect, a parasite on the social body.
He argues that taking her money to fund his own brilliant university career and future philanthropic efforts was an atonement for 100 sins.
He tells himself he isn't committing murder. He's doing the math of human progress.
He turns a living, breathing, complex human being into a flat abstraction. He turns her into an obstacle to be bypassed. And the novel is a stark, unyielding warning about the extreme danger of doing exactly that.
Whenever you reduce people to material, to mere data points, or to stepping stones for your grand theories, you invariably destroy your own humanity in the process.
Which leads to one of the most powerful moments in the entire narrative. Raskolnikov is trying to explain to Sonia why he did it.
He cycles through all his intellectual excuses. He needed the money. He wanted to be a benefactor. He wanted to prove he was Napoleon.
And finally, the intellectual facade cracks, and he has a horrifying realization. He admits to her, "Did I murder the old woman? I murdered myself, not her. I crushed myself once for all, forever."
He realizes he didn't kill an abstraction. He killed a human being. The book serves as a brutal warning against what Dostoevsky calls bookish dreams.
Theories that attempt to replace the actual messy, emotional, and interconnected reality of human life with cold, calculated logic always end in bloodshed and isolation.
You cannot logic your way out of a conscience.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the grand takeaway of this story completely changes how we view justice.
Raskolnikov's true punishment did not begin when he finally broke down, went to the explosive gunpowder atmosphere of the police station, and confessed.
Nor did it begin when he was chained and sent to the frozen prison camps in Siberia to serve his 8-year sentence.
The punishment began the very second the axe fell, locking him instantly and permanently inside the inescapable prison of his own mind.
The external authorities were entirely secondary to the internal collapse.
A prison where every shadow on the wall is a deadly threat, where every casual conversation is a trap set by a detective, and where your own intelligence is the very tool torturing you. We warmly invite you to experience this fever dream of a novel for yourself, to physically feel the psychological tension, the sweltering heat of the St. Petersburg summer, and the crushing, undeniable weight of human conscience.
It is an experience you won't forget.
You can immerse yourself in this unparalleled auditory experience by returning to the Clarin Ratio audiobook of Crime and Punishment.